Hello and welcome to episode 8 of the Racquetball Show podcast. In this episode, we have an instructional segment that is the 10 steps to master any skill, as well as an interview with Adam Mania and Nick Riffle, who are newcomers to the IRT Tour. Hope you enjoy episode 8.
Will be the greatest player to ever play the game.
Anybody who won't dive for it
shouldn't be playing.
Get that ball. Get the ball.
Welcome to the instructional segment of episode 8. So in this one, it's going to be kind of similar to the one I talked about a few episodes ago, which was how to have the optimal practice. And I stumbled upon something. I do a lot of reading, and specifically in the personal development realm. So this is from, it's a concept I stole from Brendan Burchard's High Performance Habits, which is a book that I just read. And he talks about 6 habits, essentially, that make up high performance people. And one of them is increasing your productivity. And specifically how to master skills and become insanely good at a certain thing. And reading it, I couldn't help but relate it to racquetball, of course, as I do with many things. And I wanted to lay out what Brendan says and then kind of go through how specifically you can relate that to your racquetball game. So this is a 10-step process that Brendan defines for how to become insanely good at any particular skill. And of course, you can relate this to just about anything in life, but I think specifically with racquetball, that's what I'm going to be talking about here, at least. So you can do the math on how you want to relate that to other things in life, and I think it will serve you well in other realms, but this will be racquetball specific. Okay, so the 10 steps to progressive mastery, as he calls it, are 1, determine a skill that you want to master. 2, set specific stretch goals on your path to developing that skill. 3, attach high levels of emotion and meaning to your journey and your results. 4, identify the factors critical to your success and develop your strengths in those areas, and fix your weaknesses with equal fervor. 5, develop visualizations that clearly imagine what success and failure look like. 6, schedule challenging practices developed by experts or through careful thought. 7, measure your progress and get outside feedback. 8, socialize your learning and efforts by practicing or competing with others. 9, continue setting higher level goals that you keep improving. And 10, teach others what you are learning. So relating this specifically to racquetball, let's go back through the steps. Number 1, determine a skill that you want to master. In this case, I mean, you could at a high level just say, I want to master the game of racquetball, or you could break it down and say, I want to master my serve, I want to master my backhand, I want to master footwork, whatever it is. But let's say just racquetball in general. 2, set specific stretch goals on your path to developing that skill. So depending on what level you're at, you want to set a goal that is high for yourself, but in the realm of possibility. Certainly an achievable goal, but something that's going to push you. So this might be, I don't know, winning women's B at the U.S. Open, or winning, you know, signing up for my first pro event and being competitive with the other athletes. Whatever it is, whatever would be a stretch goal for you, set it and write it down so that it's in ink and you'll go back to it and remember it. 3, attach high levels of emotion and meaning to your journey and your results. And this one might seem skippable, but it's really important. I think when you have attached, when you've deeply seated like neurotic benefits deep within your unconscious, and that sound a little bit out there, but when you can connect to specifically why this makes you, your goal makes you emotionally happy and emotionally excited to be putting in the work, it will have a much greater effect, even though consciously it might not immediately make sense. 4, identify the factors critical to your success and develop your strengths in those areas. So For instance, I think it's helpful to identify what is going to get you the best bang for your buck in terms of if I put in just a little bit of effort, it can vastly improve my game. So I think for a lot of people, that's the serve or footwork or conditioning. So if you're in not great shape, improving your conditioning can have a major effect on how you play. So identifying the factors that can quickly develop your game overall is huge. 5, develop visualizations that clearly imagine what success and failure look like. So obviously visualization is a major tool, but I think it's largely overlooked. So if you visualize yourself having won a match or having won a tournament that you have wanted to win, but visualize yourself having done it. And then when you're in that specific moment, you won't be as nervous because your unconscious mind will have seen you as someone who's already done the thing you want to do rather than someone who is a pretender who thinks they can do it but really has little chance of doing it. 6, schedule challenging practices developed by experts or through careful thought. So obviously you can reach out to someone who's an expert, maybe pay a little bit of money to have them help you develop an amazing practice. Or you can sit down and really think through, you know, what are my goals? What do I want to improve at? And really carefully think out what I want my, given my time constraints and everything else, what do I want my practices to look like? 7, measure your progress and get outside feedback. So measuring your progress is a thing a lot of people don't do. And I think if you actually write down and have a journal or a log of here's how many out of 10, and actually Nick talks specifically about this in this episode, how many out of 10 serves am I getting in on a particular attempt? And then chart that over time. What gets measured gets managed. So if you chart how you're doing, you are going to improve like almost definitely. 8, socialize your learning and efforts by practicing or competing with others. This one's a little bit obvious, but I think we're competitive beings, generally speaking. So if you can get out there with others, it not only makes it more fun, but having somebody to compete with, especially if they're at your level, can be huge for your game. 9, continue setting higher level goals so that you keep improving. So as you do step 1 and you either move past it or that time is up, set another stretch goal and then another until before you know it, you're way ahead of where you were at the beginning. 10, teach others what you're learning. This one doesn't seem like it would be that helpful, but actually teaching someone can reveal where you have kind of gaps in your knowledge. I've found that, you know, while I feel like I'm an expert on the forehand because I've hit so many, when somebody asks me, how do you hit a forehand, I'll go through explaining it and I'll, for the most part, have a good answer. But then I'll come across a part where I'm like, wait, I don't know exactly what your head movement should be when you're 3/4 of the way through the swing or whatever it is. But teaching can help clarify for yourself what it is you're trying to do. And by teaching it to others, you greatly learn and enhance your own game and your own skills. So follow that 10-step process. I know that's a little lengthy, but I've found that to be really helpful, not only in racquetball, but in a lot of things in life. Returning to this 10-step process, maybe not, it doesn't have to be exact, but following those steps can greatly improve your skills at anything you want to improve. The Racquetball Show is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, weightlifters, vegetarians, and racquetball players get lower rates on their life insurance. Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people. Health IQ can save customers up to 33% because physically active people have a 56% lower risk of heart disease, 20% lower risk of cancer, and a 58% lower risk of diabetes compared to people who are inactive. Like saving money on your car insurance for being a good driver, Health IQ saves you money on your life insurance for living a health-conscious lifestyle. To see if you qualify, to learn more, or to get a free quote on life insurance, you can visit healthiq.com/TRS. Link in the podcast description. This is a great way of supporting the podcast and of potentially getting great savings on your life insurance. Check them out. So I'm here with Adam Mania and Nick Riffle, two guys who are doing their first year on the IRT Pro Tour. Adam and Nick, thanks for being with me. Good to have you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So my first question, how has the first year on the IRT Tour been for you?
It's been a lot. It's been awesome. You know, I mean, traveling, seeing all the different places, seeing so many people that just have such passion for the sport. It's really been very cool and an awesome experience to, you know, compete all over the country and see those folks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. It's been quite the experience. You always dream of playing the IRT full time, and now that I'm finally doing it, it's a dream come true. And battling and grinding and playing against a bunch of people that share that same passion for you, and you ask people, what do you do? And it's like, I play racquetball. And it's like, oh man, you don't see that very often. So it's cool hanging around all the people that just play racquetball, and that's really what they love to do in life, like myself. So it's good.
Totally. So is there anything interesting that maybe you didn't expect before doing the grind of the tour?
I didn't expect all the aches and pains. as you go through the tournament, I wake up, like, especially during the turns, I'm like, man, I'm so sore and I only played one game. Like, what's up with this? Or, so I'd say more the aches and pains right now. I'm still getting used to battling like that and then coming back the next day and battling again. It's a lot different than junior play or just playing at home. So I'd say that's been the biggest surprise. And then definitely the pace of the ball, too, is a lot different than what, even though Nick has the hardest backhand I've ever seen in the whole world.
Yeah, pretty much.
No, but the pace of the ball definitely is takes some getting used to as well.
Yeah.
I'd say I agree with that. I mean, the pace, not so much aches and pains, because, you know, I don't get anything like that out
of ever.
ever. But, exactly. No, yeah, definitely the pace and just probably just like the slow progress, you know. And what I mean by that is it's like each tournament, you know, you're improving, but you wish you'd improve so much faster, but you can see that you're definitely improving. So,
yeah. And Adam, you mentioned the aches and pains, and you're coming off essentially two knee surgeries.
Yeah.
So talk about the process of that, like how it happened and then how difficult it's been coming back or easier.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I had one knee surgery. I had a torn meniscus. And so what they did first is called a bucket handle tear, and so they had to scope out a little bit of my meniscus, but then kind of sewed it down and tried to make sure this bucket handle tear they didn't have to take out my meniscus. So I went through 6 months of rehab, and me being the not so smart person that I am, I got cleared, and a week later I was training at the Junior USA camp with the juniors. I was a coach that year, and I was running down the incline and tore that meniscus right again, tore out all the stitches. So, the doctor said I was good. So I thought, oh, you know, I'll just kind of go back to 100% speed. Well, that didn't work out. So tore it, ended up having to take out my meniscus. So I have like 30% left in my right knee. And then that was about another 2-3 months of rehab. And then now I still wear a brace. I don't really need it, but I wear it just for the comfort, and it's been challenging. It's tough when you come back after that time and you're like, man, I used to be at this level and now I'm below this level and I have to work back up to this level. But, you know, it's just the same process that everyone else goes through. And now I'm healthier. I stretch all the time, and you just have to do a little extra precautionary work, but it's all good.
As a side note, that's what just happened to Rocky, right? He tore his meniscus,
exactly.
And it's less than a month after his surgery.
Yeah, my dad was telling me that as well, and I could not believe that he's back already. That is crazy. I wonder how much they took out of him, but
I wonder how much ibuprofen he's taking.
Yeah, he must be taking a ton. Yeah, but good for him. I wish him the best, because it's definitely not a fun surgery. It's kind of stinks, but
yeah, well, maybe it was for him.
Yeah,
he's making it look easy.
Yeah, seriously.
So what is it that you guys do off the court?
Well,
what do you do for work? Let's start with that.
What do I do for work? So I'm a front end web developer, pretty much. I do programming and create web applications for a company called Workday. So that's my full time job. I work 40 hours a week. Then I get off of work and basically eat food and go to the gym for, you know, 2 to 4 hours every day. And that's kind of what life looks like, you know. And
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of just, yeah, going to the gym, you get a weight workout in, and then you'll, you know, do drills on court and then do some cardio on court, and that's life.
It's been good. Not a bad life.
Yeah.
Yeah, for myself, I just graduated college from CU, and so I graduated with a mechanical engineering degree, and I am trying to figure out what I'm going to do with my life. I'm going on a trip to Southeast Asia for a month with my friends, and then once I get back from that, we'll kind of figure out what life is going to look like. But right now I'm thinking hopefully I find a job that can supplement my income, and then as long as they allow me to play racquetball as well, because I want to keep playing racquetball and traveling the pro tour. So yeah.
Yeah, totally. Great to be able to have kind of a full-time gig and still be able to travel and do the pro tour.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. What does your training schedule typically look like?
For myself, it's probably about 2 to 3 times a week I do cardio. So I've been getting into swimming a lot because I am the worst swimmer in the world, and it is the best cardio workout for me. I look like a dead fish in the water, but it works out well. So I do about 2 to 3 times a week I do cardio. Then I play with Nick about another, play 2 to 3 times a week as well. And I do lifting about 2 to 3 times a week as well. So it's and then just a lot of stretching. Whenever I have free time, I stretch or I do yoga, and you wouldn't be able to tell that I do it because I am still the least flexible person in the world. But that's kind of how a normal week looks like for me right now.
Yeah, and you guys typically play a lot together because you're both in Boulder, Colorado.
Exactly. Nice. Yeah, we train together, and it's so annoying playing him because he is at my shot before I even hit it.
Yep.
And he's been a great person to train with, and without him and me, we wouldn't be where we're at today. So
nice.
It's cool.
That's great.
Yeah. I'll definitely second. It's annoying playing somebody all the time. They know all your shots. Even this tournament, I was playing against Charlie, and Adam told me after the match that he was outside calling every serve to where it was going to go and shot. So I was like, oh, you knew exactly where it was going.
Yeah.
But as far as training schedule for myself, it's probably lifting 2 to 3 times a week, playing with Adam 2 to 3 times a week. I'll drill probably 4 to 6 times a week. And then usually I'll try after drilling just to do like footwork drills and more cardio kind of stuff. Lately, actually, I've been really getting to squash. So I've been doing I'll play squash 2 times a week maybe, and just play a stupid amount of squash. And
wow.
And to me, squash is like an awesome workout. It's like a really perfect cross training thing for racquetball for myself. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of my training schedule and just what I do outside of tournaments.
He's trying to get better at squash, so I don't donut him like I normally do when we play
in squash.
I don't think you've ever donut him. I don't believe.
I can see you guys both being good at squash. Do you do that just for the kind of cardio benefits, the workout benefits?
For me, it's the cardio. It's huge. Yeah, because you know, racquetball, I feel like as you get better, you run less and less. Generally, is my perspective what I've seen. I mean, like, it's true. Like, you have matches where you're diving and stuff, but if you look at racquetball versus like playing squash, to me, like, the goal of squash is pretty much like running and lunging and like the ball doesn't bounce, so you have to run to the ball, and it's like racquetball. As you get better, I mean, you could have a match where you don't run a lot because you're just staying in the middle of the court, and Adam just keeps hitting the ball to you. So you're like, thanks, man.
Well, yeah, that's Adam.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but the squash is like, not at all. Like, the whole time you're just sprinting.
That's interesting. I feel like I've found that as you get higher in level, the physicality matters more and more. Maybe not necessarily running, but a lot of leg work, a lot of footwork, cardio.
I would say that's generally true, but my perspective on racquetball is, especially just as you get better and like your serves get better and everything, to me, once you if you can serve and get in the box, like, you cannot have as much of, like, a – I mean, of course, there's tons of cardio and leg work and all that kind of stuff, but I guess my point with that is squash is relatively much more because, like, every rally you're running and the serve is initiated by, you know, a high lob generally or a hard hit. Whereas racquetball, I mean, you could ace the guy 10 times in one game, and then you're really not moving much for those points.
Totally.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Certainly much more dependent on your shot making ability than squash.
Yeah.
By
a
long shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So what's, as far as your cardio or as far as your workouts go, what is like the biggest thing you've implemented, the most helpful thing toward your game that you'd maybe advise someone to take up?
Footwork. Definitely. Yeah. Footwork is by far the most important thing for me, and I think for a lot of players, actually. It's one thing that gets overlooked all the time because it's the most boring thing to do, sitting in the court and just shadow drills or just doing a crossover and a swing and just making sure you have the right mechanics, because when it gets down late in the game, even today when I was playing against Alvaro, simple shots that I had that if I would – have had good footwork and I could put the ball away, but it's that lazy footwork and it all goes down from there. So I think footwork for me is the thing that is most important for me. When I do footwork, I play much better, and when I don't do footwork, I struggle.
Yeah, and when you work on that, what specifically do you do?
There's just little drills that we have, like star drills, or it's just like crossover drills where you're shuffling and hitting the ball, or you're return of serve, how you move return of the serve, and just basically implementing any movements that you would hit, but that you would do in a normal rally, but just practice that over and over again. So when you're in the rally, it's second nature and you don't have to think about it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. It's like footwork is massive in racquetball, and if you can't get your feet under yourself, you're going to skip the ball or leave the ball up. And so many people I know, myself, big time still, is like, you know, you're just running around the court. Sometimes you feel like a chicken with their head cut off. And once you get that footwork going, then it's like, now you're running around like a chicken with head cut off, and you're hitting the ball well. So, you know, that's a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I find that the way I like to think of it is, I think the ultimate thing you can do in racquetball, because everyone kind of hits the ball well when it's a drop and hit, like
exactly.
A setup.
Yep.
So if you can make more and more shots the equivalent of that, if you can get the ball to a point where it's at your front knee, even on tough shots, you're going to be so much more effective than if you're lunging for it or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
What do you think? What do you think is the most important?
It's footwork as far as what I've implemented into my game. So footwork and like leg strength are, as far as my workouts, that's probably the best bang for your buck thing that I've implemented.
Totally. I would agree.
Into my workouts. Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. 100% We need somebody to come on and argue. So as far as tips that you'd have for like a beginner or an intermediate player, what is probably the one thing you'd tell most of those people?
I would say if you're just getting into racquetball, just have fun. You know, I mean, it's like, as far as technicality and stuff goes, you know, I mean, it is super important, you know, and getting on the court and doing drills is like, you're going to get that consistency, but just have fun, enjoy the sport, you know, just like think about the things that, like, you know, if you miss a shot, think about, you know, okay, maybe I should have done this, but you don't have to grill yourself on it if you're just getting started. Just kind of enjoy it. Just kind of,
yeah.
Yeah, I like that. For more intermediate player, I'd say just focus on hitting the front wall, and it sounds so simple, but if you can hit the front wall and not skip and not beat yourself, that is one of the biggest things, even for me today, where if you just hit the front wall and make your opponent either kill the ball or them skip, you're going to go so much farther. And so just hit that big white wall in front of you first.
You'll notice me at every single level of racquetball. The difference between, you know, a D player, a C player going on up all the way to a pro player, just consistency. You know, it's whoever can hit that consistent shot the best and doesn't skip the ball. Because, I mean, if you skip the ball, you know, I mean, like Adam's saying, it's like, that's the easiest thing you can do to help your opponent win, you know, like you just gotta be consistent and hit your shots.
Yeah. What do you find are the best ways to build that consistency?
Simple drop and hits, I would say, at a beginning level, is just over and over and over, because if you can't get the fundamental down of the ball being still, then you can't move to the next step of when the ball's moving fast. So drop and hit, and it's the most boring thing to do, probably outside of footwork, but I'd say just drop and hit and make sure that you're hitting the ball clean and you're hitting it flat and all the above, and just make sure you're consistent with the drop and hit first, and then you can move up to setups and faster balls. But I'd say start with your drop and hit, and from there there's a lot more good things that will happen.
Nice.
Yeah, I would just building off that. I mean, drop and hits, just doing them over and over again, and like having in your head the like your ideal shot, and then being able to just drop and hit that ball and hit it, you know, track your percentages, you know, like see how you're improving. That's like, to me, kind of how I've found myself improving consistency, is just get on the court, hit that same down the line shot, and then just track, all right, I did, you know, 7 out of 10 this time, or I did 8 out of 10, and just kind of keep watching that. And that's going to help you, for one, track your progress, and for two, just actually get that consistency going.
Do you get pretty specific when you work out? Do you track your own progress like that, or do you record metrics of what you're doing?
Generally, I hit or miss, you know, sometimes it gets very tedious to get on the court and do it, but I would say drop and hits, not as much. Serves, I definitely do. I'll get on the court with serves and just, you know, I'll hit 10, 10, 10, 10 on each side, and I'll track those percentages how I do. And then just, you know, do it again the next time you go out and just kind of watch and see what you're doing. And I would say I do. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, you can tell we talk a lot in our doubles players. We have all the same things to say. We're the we bounce ideas off each other all the time.
It's like I'm interviewing one
exactly,
person.
Exactly. Yeah. Coach by the same person play all the time.
Interview Adam now and ask him the same question twice.
Basically.
Okay, so what's one interesting habit that you have in your game? Maybe like a superstition you have, or some intricacy to your game that's a interesting habit?
I always touch the back wall receive serve, because that's always been something I do. I've changed this recently, but I never used to warm up with my court shoes on, because my court shoes were like my game shoes, like, and I didn't wear them anytime except when I played on the game.
Interesting.
And I do have to always go to the bathroom before I play, before I start. So I'd say those are kind of my three quirky rituals that I have. Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, just going, I mean, I will say that I believe I started, you know, the habit of touching the back wall.
No,
just
because,
you know, that's what
way
I did. But that, you know, I always keep my lucky dollar in my back pocket, just always.
Do you really?
Is that true?
No, it's
way.
It's not true. But no,
Adam knew it wasn't true, because he doesn't do that.
He's
so.
I didn't keep it. I get in the habit of just touching the back wall, and just kind of resets you for each point. And that's my biggest like kind of superstition, is like after super long rally or whatever point, you just touch that back wall and it's new point. You know, you're starting over kind of thing.
Yeah, he learned that from me.
But yeah, right. But other than that, I don't do any sort of weird things with my shoes or anything like that. You know, I wear my racquetball shoes on the racquetball court. So, you know.
Nice. So, do you play any other sports outside of racquetball, or did you growing up?
I used to play soccer, and soccer is now banned from my life, unfortunately, because that is the reason I had my meniscus problems from the get go. I love that sport so much, and one day I will play it again, and one day I will get hurt again because I play it, but I love soccer so much, and
nice.
I've been getting into volleyball as well. My roommate was a really good volleyball player, so we'd go and play volleyball probably
is
about once a week.
Very good volleyball player.
Yeah, is a very good volleyball player. And so we'd go play volleyball, and so I've been getting pretty good at volleyball. I wish I could jump more, but not in the genes. I'm kind of don't got the hops, but I can dig that ball out.
Nice.
But volleyball and soccer. I miss soccer a lot. But those have been
how's that helped you in your racquetball game?
A ton. Soccer helped me so much with cardio, because there's not very many sports that you run as much as you do in soccer. And so when I would play soccer, I would never have to do cardio outside of it. I was pretty much more fit than anyone I ever played against. And then now that I don't play, I'm shape and lazy, but no. But volleyball is good too because it works on your side to side movements, and we play in the sand most of the time, so it's like an extra little workout in the sand there. But getting up and down fast and reacting to the ball, and so I enjoy those two sports. Yeah,
yeah. I would say for myself, this is where we differ. I never go the soccer thing, so you know. Lately, like I said, just a lot of squash, and I think squash is just awesome because it's the same kind of movements, but you do have to change your perspective a little bit on the court, because squash, you can't do the same thing as racquetball. You know, you have the 10 in the front, so it's not just all about killing the ball. So it definitely brings in a little bit more of a, I don't want to say cerebral part of the game, but it's a lot more of, you know, get the guy in the back court, then dink it up front, get him to the front court, dink him back, you know, just, and you're really moving your opponent, which is good. Squash, and been kind of dabbling a little bit in synchronized swimming, but not quite as much lately. Just, it's been tough with work and racquetball, but
yeah. How's your synchronized swimming helped your racquetball game?
You know, it's just something about just that consistency and structure, just in the pool, you know, with just me and, you know, all the other swimmers. We just,
you need to get Adam to do it. You'll be even more in sync in your racquetball.
I would sink if I tried synchronized swimming.
I mean, he did say he does, he swims, swimming. But, you know, he didn't tell you that he floats from side to side of the pool. So he's not.
With my floaties on my arms and my little kickboard.
What do you guys do pregame to, in order to get ready for a game? What do you do to prepare?
Typically, like a Big Mac with fries.
Nice, yeah.
No, usually just having some. Make sure you got some food in your system. Make sure you've drinking a lot of water. I found if I'm not hydrated playing racquetball, you just don't feel right. You know, just things don't feel like they're in sync. And I think that's something that a lot of people overlook in sports, but like it's huge. Like you gotta stay hydrated. Like your body doesn't function like it does when you're hydrated, you know, or dehydrated. So probably those are the biggest things. You know, just kind of chilling on your own, you know, not talk to too many people, you know. And I know some people in tournaments see that as you being a little, like, you know, rude or something if you're just sitting on your own, but I think that's big. You know, you kind of have to get yourself in the zone and just get yourself in the right place, you know. And it's tough if people are, you know, walking up and asking about, oh, what'd you do last week, you know, what were you doing for the holidays, and all that's good and great, you know, but I think the closer you get to a match, you got to limit that and just kind of really focus on what you're about to do. So
For myself, that's something I struggle with as well, is what's the best warm-up for me. I have my normal warm-up like 15 minutes before the game where I go off and I do all my exercises and I'm warm, but like the hour before is where I struggle, where I should probably be getting ready or I should be eating or something, but I'm sitting on my phone or I'm talking with people and this and that. So that's one thing I'm still trying to figure out, is what works best for me in the warm-up. I do, I have my warm-up, my normal warm-up that I've grown up with for 20, 15 minutes before the game. But outside of that, I'm still figuring that out right now.
Yeah. So this is kind of a topical question. We just switched from the best 3 out of 5 games to 11. We're now doing best 2 out of 3, you know, 2 games 15, tiebreaker 11. Yep. How are you liking that format with this being the first tournament we've done it at?
I'm a little, I don't know how much I like it right now. I was just getting used to the 3 out of 5 to 11 and getting comfortable with it. And you can kind of, the toughest part about the 2 out of 3 to 15 with the tiebreaker to 11 is you got to come out of the gates quick. There's no more giving up the first game and then being able to work your way back into the game. You have to come out and you have to take that first game, or you have to put in a fight. And it's just the mindset. Like a lot of times if people were down 9-0, 10-0 in a game, you're kind of like, all right, let's get ready for the next game and stuff like that. But you can't do that anymore. You have to fight every game and you have to come out of the gates firing. There's no, all right, I'll get the next two or I'll get the next ones. Like you have to come out of the gates and you have to make sure you're fighting every point. So it's good, but like anything, it just takes some getting used to, and we're all gonna adjust to it, and that's the way it's gonna be. So that's what we're gonna do.
I I would say it's a little weird, you know. I mean, you always play best out of three, you know, leading up to playing pro, and then you play pro and you expect the whole 3 out of 5. At least I have, just because I've always kind of grown up with that being the how it is. But I would say I don't mind it. You know, I mean, we're still out here playing the game we love and still just having fun doing it. So end of the day, it doesn't really matter. But I think from a sport perspective, it's definitely understandable why it all happened, you know, just for, you know, making the game more momentum based and someone can come out hot and win a match by coming out hot kind of thing. But personally, I think I don't know, I think that kind of takes away from the pro ball a little bit, because I think for me, you know, like having that ability to have those three games, that longer time length, you know, like it gives kind of more time for momentum swings and to change. And so I guess for me, with the best 3 out of 5, generally you're going to see the person who's more fit and more prepared and ready to win the match. And I think with the best 2 out of 3, I mean, generally that's still going to happen, but it just opens the door up for folks who just come out of the gate swinging and playing hot, you know? So
yeah. Totally. Yeah, I think it makes a much higher chance for upsets. And it's also, I found with the best 3 out of 5, 2-11, guys would kind of throw away a game.
Exactly.
Like, realize I'm down a few points, I'll let this one go. Doesn't matter too much. Now it's like every point really matters.
Yep, exactly.
Or another case is like if you're down big in a game, you're always going to be fighting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which, yeah.
Totally. What do you think about it? What do you?
Honestly, I'm just kind of even on it. I'm still not really sure why it was implemented.
Yeah.
Me neither. In the sense that it didn't seem like something a bunch of people were calling for.
Yeah.
I'm always happy to experiment with new styles, especially given our sport is struggling a little bit. But to me, it doesn't make that big of a difference.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
What are some ways you guys see as good ideas to grow the sport of racquetball?
I think 100% just juniors and high school programs, and seeing what, you know, like Oregon and Missouri's done with their high school programs is massive. You know, I mean, you got to spread that, you know, across country and have more, you know, more states just incorporating that into their high school programs or just their just school programs in general, where it gives people that opportunity to play the sport, you know, and not just like go to your gym and rent some rackets. And, you know, it's like if you sign up for a class at school and you go through a semester playing it, like I feel like one semester, I bet, will get people hooked, you know. The sport of racquetball is so much, like everyone I talk to, it's like once you play it once, like you're like, wow, this is fun, like I would like to do this more, you know. So, and I think that's kind of the key, is just getting people on the court. And if you can put it incorporate into high school programs or, you know, middle school programs, something like that, that's like, to me, the best way that the sport itself will grow.
Yeah, I think a lot of people view it as like, do we start by helping out the pro tour, making the pro tour better, or do we start kind of at the ground roots? And I agree with you, where I think starting at the ground roots, you know, starting with the kids and juniors is the best way to make things grow. Yeah.
Well, there's so many people that you'll talk to, you know, saying you play racquetball, and especially if you tell them, yeah, I'm trying to play professional racquetball, that so many people at a local rec center are like, there's professional racquetball, you know? So to me, just on that note, like, it doesn't make sense to help out the, like, to really try to boost the pro side, because to me, that really just helps the people who are already in the sport, and that doesn't really actually get new people into the sport.
Yeah.
Because new people in the sport generally don't even know there's pro racquetball, because, I mean, we don't, it's not like we have a lot of TV coverage. We do have, you know, streaming stuff, which has been awesome. The RT Network and them have been just great, just broadcasting. But I think really that's more for people who are already in the sport, and that's not so much for the new people coming in or trying to come in, at least.
Yeah, and I found another thing I think is that oftentimes when we're making changes to tournaments or thinking about how to run things, we take into account the perspective of someone who's been playing for a long time.
Exactly, yep.
And I think you almost would be better off focusing on the perspective of someone who hasn't played a tournament or has played one tournament and is considering not playing anymore.
Yeah.
Yep.
Consider that perspective and try to make things easier for those people to play more tournaments, because, I don't know, the racquetball junkies, like us three here, we're going to play regardless.
Yep. Yeah.
So
yep.
That's what I found.
I would agree with that big time. I mean, tournaments, like, you think somebody who's never played a tournament before, if you enter into a big tournament, this kind of opens up a can of worms, but you enter into a big tournament and it's single elimination. You know, you play that one match, you're done. This is your first tournament. That is extremely discouraging. And like, you're like, wow, like, I just spent, you know, what, $50 to $100 to play in this tournament, and I'm done. You know, so to me, a big thing for thinking of new people getting to the sport is, you know, giving them more games or more playtime in a tournament. And that's so hard, you know, because you only have a limited amount of time in a club. But if there's somehow that you can, you know, even just like shorter games, but allow them to play other people, you know, like that's why people play tournaments, is like that they want to get that experience of playing new people. And if they only play one person and they're done, like that's not going to want to make them stick around or go participate in other tournaments. They'll just play locally. So I think that's something that eventually, like, it needs to kind of be addressed or changed at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with Nick, with the, of course, but
there we go.
I'm going to go a different angle, just because we've been agreeing so much. But I think in order to grow the professional ball, I think there needs to be a more marketing aspect to it. We have so many cool plays that go on and on the rallies, and there's so many cool highlights. Like, I see the Sports Center, and that was cool when racquetball got on the Sports Center top 10. It was awesome. But I see plays all the time, and I'm like, man, like racquetball, we have so many of these highlights that are so much better than just a dunk that you see in the NBA all the time.
Yeah.
Like, and those guys have a ton of talent, don't get me wrong, but we also have a lot of talent here. So I think there should be more push for a marketing of professional racquetball to get that out there. I know that's tough, but have someone that's dedicated to just editing film and putting it out there and growing it. I see that a lot with the WRT as well. And they're a little, actually, they're kind of the same size. I don't know the size, actually, but I like how they really do all their, and sometimes it gets a little overboard. And you're like, all right, I've seen this. But
yeah.
I do think that a little marketing effort of spreading the word, and also it was interesting. I know you talked about Marky Rojas's article and how he was kind of pushing like for music, and I agree, there has to be more things that get outsiders to come into the rec center, or there's more that someone knows that this tournament's going on. Cause I, like, for example, we had an Uber driver that we told, we're here for a rack culture. It's like, oh man, I'd love to come check it out. I didn't even know that this was around. Or we had one guy in the hotel yesterday that was like, oh man, I love racquetball. Like, where is it at? I want to come see it. And,
sure.
And this. And so I know there's interest, but I just don't, like, we have to figure out a way as a racquetball community to spread that word more and figure out whether that's through Facebook or whether that's through, I don't know. But I think marketing plan of some sort, I think, will be most important for professional ball. And I agree with the juniors to start the ground roots, but as far as spreading the professional, I think some kind of marketing deal.
I think that kind of goes back to what you were saying, Dylan, where it's like tournament directors and tournaments and stuff, they cater to players who are already in the sport. And I think it's similar with our marketing. Like, the marketing's channels that we currently have are very catered to people who are aware of them and have, you know, like, you know, whether it's USAR, you know, the racquetball events site, or, you know, me, sometimes Facebook, but not as much, I would say. But yeah, just somehow accessing those different channels of, you know, getting to people who wouldn't normally see these events, or, you know, locally somehow, like, getting it into, you know, some sort of broadcast to let people in the area know. It's like, hey, you've got a pro racquetball tournament here, you know, and somehow let them know. And that's, it's tough. I mean, I don't know what the answer exactly would be for that.
Yeah,
but
me neither.
But I totally agree with Adam, though. It's like, if you have somebody, like, editing videos and putting out, like, just crazy cool videos of, like, you know, good rallies and stuff like that, like, it doesn't matter who you are. If you see people doing that, you're going to be kind of curious, like, what was that, you know? I mean, people always show the rally from U.S. Open, right? The doubles match. And it's like, you spread those kind of rallies out there, like, you know, people are going to be like, wow, this looks pretty cool. Like, what is that, you know? Like,
totally.
You don't see that in a basketball game, you know? Basketball, yeah, you shoot, they dunk. Oh, awesome. But that, you're diving, you know, you're picking up rollouts, you know, everything. It's like there's such a with racquetball, there's such an ability to market it just based off of matches and like the rallies that there are in the matches, and they're like pretty commonplace, you know, and people don't realize that like a single tournament, you have so many like highlight reel moments, you know, that you can easily spread out there, and people just
probably a few every match.
Yeah, exactly.
And then if you have guys who are typically divers, you know, they're
I think people would just love that and eat that up. And so I think that's just I agree, we somehow have to have a better way of getting that out to the public.
I think a lot of the people who end up seeing it, like the way it's kind of marketed now, the people who are going to see it are already obsessed with racquetball.
Exactly.
And there's not, you need to do something for outreach. And I think, because we do share videos of full matches online, which is great, but again, if I'm like new to the sport,
you're
or haven't played the sport, I'm not going to watch an 80 minute match.
I don't
and I don't have an appreciation for the technical aspects of the sport.
Yep.
Just because it's totally new. So, yeah, I think doing things that would draw in people who are new to the sport or beginners or something like that would be super big.
Yeah, I agree. And I think another big thing is kind of implement what big companies are doing, like SportsCenter. They're purely a highlight company, basically. And so maybe we, after every tournament, you put together 5 or 10 of the best highlights, talk about the wins and who upset who, or if Kane destroyed everyone again, or whatever it may be,
and just
kind of just recap it, so that if you missed it or you don't want to watch the full thing, you can sit in for a 5-minute deal that gets you caught up, and then you're more likely to watch it, and not just me or us, like people that have never seen the sport, and then that might grab their attention to watch the next one. So I think that can be one way we improve, but it's tough because money's short in the sport. So I mean, it's easy to say that when you have a big crew and a lot of people to work it with, but I think, I don't know, maybe starting at a small level and then working your way up from there. So
That's what I think. I think another big thing is the stories of the athletes and of the sport, kind of storylines, which sort of what I'm trying to do with this.
Yeah.
But there, I think, needs to be more of that.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. Interest for people is oftentimes not necessarily in the technical aspects of the sport, you know.
Totally.
Who has a better backhand? Who's going to, like,
win
this match? It's a lot in the storyline, or, you know, you get to know a player and then you're excited to be behind that guy.
Or even something simple like the football games. Before the game, they do their predictions on who's going to win. And it just kind of gets the pot stirring, basically. And it's just like, oh, you don't think my team's going to win, or you don't think this player's going to win? And whether they believe it or not, they're just doing it to kind of get the pot stirring and see who's right. And then, just kind of have input there. And so I think those are small little things that maybe can be inputted into it. But I don't know.
I like it.
Yeah.
So what do you guys see as goals for your game, or where do you envision your game going in the next few years?
I would say goals for me. I mean, by the, I don't know. I mean, I have personal goals and stuff that are, you know, somewhat specific and everything. But I know just, you know, continually improving and continually, you know, placing higher and higher, making it to the deeper rounds in a tournament. Right now it's like, you know, you'll make the occasional round of 16, you know. Just a goal for that is just like, you know, be consistently taught with round of 16. And then from there, you know, of course, quarters and then semis. And, you know, your goal is just to continually improve. So, but I mean, as long as I keep having fun with it and stuff, you know, that's just kind of the goal. And I think as long as you love something and you keep putting work in, you're going to improve just naturally. So that's kind of my goal right now, is just keep having fun with it, keep doing what I've been doing, and just trying to, you know, start breaking into those top ranks. So
A goal for me is really to just be able to continue playing all the stops. I never know with my knee what's going to happen, so and me is just keep grinding and keep playing, and then knocking off the big guys and making a big win. That's what I need right now. I've been close, but I need the big win. And once you get one big win, then the ball starts rolling and things start to happen. So I think the biggest thing is just staying mentally tough in there, because it's so easy to go, oh, I'm playing the top 3 guys, or I'm playing the 2 seed, or I'm playing the 1 seed. Oh, it's over. It's staying in it and being like, all right, come, this time's going to be better. And so I think the biggest goal for me is just staying mentally in it and not letting down based on who I play. Just keep playing my game and good things will end up happening from there.
Nice.
Yeah.
So if you were to take yourself out of the picture of racquetball, who would you see as the next number one player? Who would dethrone Kane?
In what time frame?
Just the next guy to guy to do it. I mean, it could be when he's 50. Who knows?
And we can't say ourselves.
You can't say yourselves. Okay. Yeah, that's you're excluding yourself from the picture.
That's tough. Adam, what do you think?
That's a good one. I would say. It's it's tough because he's so dominant right now. I used to always think, like, you know, like, he's good. And then I got on the court with him in St. Louis, and I was like, yikes, this guy is as good as he said he is. But I'd say the next person to
So sorry to interrupt you, but, like, to me, like, it's so hard to say, you know. I mean, we had Portland, like, a month ago where it's like we saw Charlie come through and win it, you know. And so, and, you know, maybe people expect that or didn't expect that, you know. It's, but I would just say that after Kane, it's like the playing field is relatively close, you know. So it's really hard to just say one person's going to be that number one because, in my opinion, like, I think if you took Kane out of the picture and ourselves, then you would, like, it would be a different person, like, every tournament, you know, like, like, at least for a while. I, sure, you know, you've got the Rockies who are very consistently in the finals. But it's, I mean, he got beat last month, too, you know, and same with Alvaro and De La Rosa and all those guys. So it's, like, any, you know, and that's always been the beauty of the sport. But any given day, you know, somebody can beat anybody, you know. And until Kane came along recently, it's, like, there was just that, like, you know, whoever played, if somebody had a hot day, they were going to win, you know. And especially with this new 2-out-of-3 game format there is, it's, like, that makes it even more so. Like, one hot day and, you know, anybody. So I guess for me, I really can't say that there's anybody in particular that I would say this guy's going to be the next, like, you know. And I think part of it too is we have this perception right now that's like, if you're number one, you're dominant, you know. And, like, we're thinking Kane stuff right here, but, like, to me, it's not really that. It's like there'll be more like four or five guys who are going to rotate all through that one spot.
Yeah, so that'd be totally interesting once Kane has kind of moved on from the sport. Just what the next crop of what that IRT picture looks like.
Totally. Yeah, and I totally agree. It's so close. Yeah, I mean, everyone can see it. Kane's at a different level right now, and we're all trying to get up to that level. But he's just at a different level. That's just what it is. So, yeah, it's tough to say what the next.
It's hard to name the next one.
I mean, there are a ton of good talented players out there, but to pin down one right now, I'm not too sure.
I would say without Kane, if you looked at the top 10 people after him, all of them could be the next number one.
Interesting.
And they'll probably all rotate. So that'd be my thought there.
Why do you think he's been able to be so dominant? What particular traits do you think lend themselves to him being as good as he is?
I would say just the consistency that he's, you know, I mean, he's hitting these shots from anywhere and he doesn't miss, you know. It's like his percentages are crazy, and they're not just percentages of just hitting the ball, they're percentages of he hits the ball and rolls it, you know. And I just don't think anybody else has those percentages.
Why do you think that is, though? I mean, does he train more? Is it genetic?
You know, I would say a combination, you know. I mean, of course, with all sports, you know, I mean, you've got, you know, superstars in different sports and stuff, and it's definitely genetic. But there's also, I mean, I'm sure he's worked his butt off, you know, for just trying to get to where he is. And, I mean, he's like, what, 35, 34?
Sounds about right.
Somewhere in that range.
Yeah, somewhere in
there. You know, I mean, so it's like, I'm sure he's put in before then. He's probably put in 15 years or 20 years of just hard work on the court, hard work in the gym, and just putting in time. So it's like, yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's some genetic stuff, but I'm sure he's just worked his butt off and gotten to where he is too.
Yeah.
You know? I think one of the biggest things, since I work with we both work with Winterton, looking at his fundamentals, they're just so solid, better than any player right now. Like, it's just his forehand and his backhand are just the same stroke every time, and so smooth and so flat that it allows him to kill the balls, and it allows him to be very consistent because his swing is so fundamentally sound. And then, of course, his serve is just ridiculous.
Yeah. Did you have some experience with that serve?
Yeah, item? I did. And it's a whole new serve. So, I mean, that was one of the bigger things I found, too, is that the serve, it took me two and a half games to get used to, and by that time, it's over, basically. So, his serve is, it's so important at this level to have a good serve. So, that's another thing that sets him apart is the consistency in his serve. It is a monster.
Yeah, sure is.
So, yeah.
Great. Yeah, well, thanks for coming on, guys. Do you have any parting thoughts?
I would just say, I mean, first of all, thanks for having us. Thanks for what you're doing with all this. I mean, this is awesome, just spreading, you know, awareness of racquetball and just kind of putting more information out there to the racquetball community and hopefully other people who aren't necessarily in the racquetball community, but I think that's just awesome what you're doing. So I appreciate you having us on. It's cool.
Cool. Thanks for coming on. Do you, anything you want to plug, anything like that?
No, thanks for what you're doing, man. It's pretty cool to get more of, like we were just talking about with the marketing, like just more awareness out there and get more people involved. And so you're doing awesome, man, and thanks for having us.
Yeah, what you don't know is secretly I'm just like taking all your advice, taking like your training secrets and just it's a selfish thing.
Hey, whatever it is, it's good.
All right, well, glad you think so. All right, thanks for coming on, guys.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
And that's all we have for episode 8 of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed. As always, you can reach out at dylan@racquetballshow.com if you want to email me. That's dylan@racquetballshow.com. Send me any questions, concerns, feedback, or funny videos, or whatever you have my way, and I'd appreciate it.